You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Buncher. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be rejoined today by Brandon Katz, who is the senior entertainment industry strategist at Parrot Analytics. Brandon, we had you on the show back in like January, February. It's good to have you back on. We're going to be talking a very important topic, churn. We're going to be talking churn.
I think important for you, I, and other industry observers, but if we try to talk about it with our friends outside the industry, their eyes would glaze over in 0.3 milliseconds.
Well, and it's fascinating too, because I don't know about you, but my experience with streaming is very unlike the rest of the world's experience with streaming, because I write about movies and TV shows. I have to subscribe to everything, and my kids love it because they're like, I want to watch some random cartoon on Paramount Plus. I want to watch something on, you know, on Netflix or whatever, Peacock. And like, they've got it all. It's like a smorgasbord for them. So that's good for them. But for most people, I think the sense I get is that they do not subscribe to everything. They subscribe to one or two things most of the time. Something like everybody subscribes to Netflix, essentially, at this point. And then they kind of cycle through the other services. Is that the general sense that you have of how people consume streaming television?
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Sonny, in the sense that I have to remind myself that my entertainment experience is completely different from the average everyday consumer. I am a crazy couch potato obsessive. Most people have social lives and they go out of the house and they get off their couches. But yes, you're absolutely right. The average consumer usually has a couple defaults, like an Amazon because of the Amazon shipping and like a Netflix, because Netflix is very much in the market, the default streamer. And then you're absolutely right that there will be a burn and churn situation. So a new season of a new Star Wars show comes out. You know, a lot of males in the kind of millennial to Gen Z range and even a little bit Gen X will subscribe, watch like an Obi-Wan, be like, wow, that was great. Now I'm getting off because there's not really a ton of other adult-oriented programming. Although now with the Hulu integration, that's slowly changing. But you're absolutely right that there's a lot of hopping around. And then there are many, many consumers who I could not recommend Ted Lasso enough, but very understandably, the pushback is, well, I don't really need to subscribe to an entire service for, you know, one show, one or two shows. So there is a lot more fill in the gaps as needed when you get outside of the devotees of the industry such as us.
Can I let me ask, From your data, do you see any difference in the churn rate when shows are released weekly versus binged all at once, the all at once model? Because in theory, right, there's this idea in our head that like if you put something out once a week, people will stick around longer. They'll sign up and they'll watch from the first episode and they'll keep going because they want to watch it with people in time. On the other hand, though, because we live in an age of time shifting and with everything eventually is going to be there all at once, you can watch it in a week instead of over the course of 2 months. Do they then just wait and, you know, wait for the show to be over and then sign up and then go for it?
Such an important question, Sonny, and it's something the whole industry continues to struggle with. And what we've seen is that there are pros and cons to the to both the binge and weekly or mixed release. And it really depends on what your platform's goal is. So a binge release can often elicit hyper bursts of super engagement. So you are having someone open your app multiple times throughout the course of the whole week to really kind of crush the latest season of Stranger Things or what have you. That obviously looks good for kind of generating habitual behavior and really reflects well for advertisers that want to see, hey, we want to get, you know, a campaign that's like 2 weeks leading into the Super Bowl or something like that. So this new hot, sexy binge release is the perfect opportunity for us to get a quick burst of bang for buck. Then on the other side, of course, we have the weekly, which tends to sustain engagement and audience demand over longer periods of time. And generally, yes, sustain or help reduce churn over that longer term period, because pretty much all of us are on monthly subscription platforms. And so if you have an 8-episode show that's going over 2 months, well, you've probably locked in those 2 months and maybe even beyond. But again, it depends on your goals. So if you're a kind of younger streamer that may not have a ton of market share, maybe like an Apple TV Plus, selectively binging shows, and that also depends on genre, may be a great way to just have a lot of intake. And from there, obviously, it's harder to retain, but at least you're getting people into the app, which you might not be doing otherwise. For more established platforms like Netflix, we're starting to see them release their biggest shows in batches. They first started off with 2 batches. Now they're even going to 3 batches for Cobra Kai, for Emily in Paris. So you're seeing a little bit more of a push towards somewhat traditional release schedules drawn out over time. So again, I know that's a bit of a complicated answer, but there are pros and cons to each strategy. Depends on where you're at as a streamer and what your goals are.
Yeah, the batch release strategy is interesting, but Netflix has the least churn problem, has the smallest churn problem of all the services, right? Is this just a first mover thing? People think of Netflix as a utility at this point, and it's like, well, that's what we're watching.
It's multiple factors. And absolutely, the first mover advantage and the perception of being the default streamer certainly has a huge, huge, huge role to play in that. The other thing is, too, that they have a massive slate of content. Here in the U.S., I believe their library is a close second to Amazon in sheer volume of titles of films and TV. And then you also have the type of content. They have so many long-running procedurals and sitcoms, you know, your Young Sheldons, your Grey's Anatomy, things like that, that have just massive banks of episodes. And that's the type of laundry folding TV that you throw on in the background. It's the type of TV that keeps you on the hook because you just need something to fall asleep to. And I think that type of programming is very, very important for retention overall. And Netflix, as the first mover and as the biggest spender pretty much, has basically accumulated a critical mass of those types of retention-driving shows. The big question longer term, I think we might have spoken about this when I was on, is the fact that linear TV isn't making as many of those shows as they once were due to declining live ratings, shrinking ad sales, and rising production costs. It's harder and harder to unearth the next Friends, Big Bang Theory, you know, NCIS. So that's going to be a problem long term for all streamers, particularly as streaming TV seasons are shorter than linear TV seasons.
Well, we did discuss this a little bit last time, but I do think it's fascinating because we think of streaming and linear as kind of separate things. We think of ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox as one thing. We think of the basic cable channels as another thing, though the basic cable channels have kind of transformed into streaming. Like, I feel like that has happened. But why is it that it is so hard to create a procedural style show on these networks? Or these streaming platforms? Because I think this is what Paramount Plus is trying to do with its Sheridan universe and everything else that they've got going on there. But I do think it does. You're right. It seems it's odd that all of these things start on network TV and then come to streaming, and none of them originate there.
Yeah, I think I push back slightly. I think you're seeing streaming do serialized procedurals or procedurals, as somebody has kind of claimed that term. And you're seeing that, you know, across streamers, like, yes, the Sheridanverse full of neo-Western crime dramas on Paramount Plus. You've got Netflix with their gourmet cheeseburgers like The Lincoln Lawyer, like The Diplomat. You've got Amazon with kind of cornering the market on dad TV, you know, your Jack Ryans and your Reachers. And all of those share a ton of creative and narrative DNA with the traditional procedurals we're used to on broadcast television. And so that has been kind of a big next step for Netflix to try for streaming to try to capture that audience. Where I think the problem and issues start to rear their head is that it doesn't make as much economic sense for the streamers to have as long of seasons as the broadcast networks. You know, it is much harder to produce a 22 episode hour long procedural on streaming, particularly in a medium that really relies on completion rates and really relies on early viewership. Now, it's not a complete absolute, but for the most part, unlike linear TV, you don't really get the opportunity to grow an audience year over year. Often, if you start low, you're going to stay low in streaming because there is that sea of choice as opposed to kind of the more limited selection you had when it was just linear TV. You also had tons of ad revenue and syndication revenue and other ancillary monetization opportunities to help prop up a show that may get critical acclaim, but start slow, but then build audience over time, like a Breaking Bad, which actually has Netflix to help potentially thank for that. So those levers aren't available to most of the streaming services that are keeping these originals on their own platform 99% of the time in perpetuity. So you can ape the type of style and creative structure of procedurals and sitcoms on streaming, but the length of episodes and the runway they have to become successful is not the same. It's not a one-to-one comparison.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Does the increasing reliance on ad sales for the streaming services make procedurals more attractive? Because, I mean, when I think of a Law and Order, I don't even really think of NBC. I think of TNT wherever they show up on basic cable. Because what I think of when I think of Law and Order is I think of like five Law and Order episodes in a row in the middle of the day that I watch when I'm sick or folding clothes or whatever. And the reason those are successful is because, A, people watch them because they're, you know, whatever. It's the same thing over and over again. People like to watch the same thing over and over again. No offense to any Law and Order fans out there. I like Law and Order just fine. But the real advantage there is that it's just chewing up time. And when you are chewing up time, you are feeding people endless rivers of advertisement.
Oh, yeah. I can't even begin to calculate the number of Monk episodes I watched when I stayed home from school sick as a kid. I mean, just incalculable. And so, yes, to your point, advertising and the rise of that definitely makes it more attractive, both from a standpoint of, hey, I'm an advertiser. I want to put my ads on your licensed library of older shows like a Monk, like a Law and Order, like a Criminal Minds. And from the sense that, again, as we just talked about, when you're bringing in additional monetization opportunities and suddenly you have additional revenue coming in, you might be a creative exec at Netflix that says, you know what, I think this season one show that had a middling performance, I think it's really good. I think there's something there. I think it can catch on. Now we potentially have enough of a financial safety net to maybe give a little bit more leeway to like, okay, we'll renew it for season two, maybe at a slightly reduced cost, see if it starts to catch on. Now, early on, of course, in Netflix's run, it was famous for not canceling anything for a long while. But that was because it was trying to validate itself and legitimize itself in the eyes of Hollywood, and it was completely new to the original content game. Now that it's more mature, as we've seen, it needs to be much more discerning.
Yeah. Let me, we're going to talk about the piece you wrote for The Observer and this Samba TV report here in a second. But one thing that really kind of jumped out at me, and I'm just checking again, I'm scrolling through your story again, because I want to make sure I'm right about this before I say it. But one thing that does not come up in your piece, and really very much in the Samba TV report, are films. Both in terms of libraries, in terms of like the acquisitions, whatever, But especially originals. There's not much talk about originals. And I find this fascinating because one of my long-running theories of streaming is that streaming is a replacement for TV. People will sign up for networks to watch buzzy new TV shows. They will almost never sign up for a specific movie. Now, when I say like a specific movie, I mean something like a Red Notice or, you know, something that like Netflix has made, like a Maestro or whatever. My working theory is that people think of streaming as TV. They go there for TV shows. The movies are a nice bonus. Is that when you're looking at the acquisition data and the churn data, how do movies figure into all of this? I mean, it feels almost entirely invisible.
Yeah, I think it's always a very interesting separation of church and state when it comes to film and TV, which I believe holistically are additive. But when you break it down to the kind of granular level of streamer by streamer and customer by customer, it becomes a lot more complicated. So, like, according to Parrot Analytics content valuation estimates, we estimated that The Instigators on Apple TV Plus was responsible for signing up around 50,000 new customers to Apple TV Plus. That's solid. You know, that is a solid performance for a movie that people seem to find, you know, fun and entertaining enough in that, I think, kind of streaming non-theatrical type of way. But at the end of the day, when we're also talking about the entire streaming ecosystem in which the goal is hundreds of millions of subscribers, we can fairly say without criticizing the good performance of that movie that perhaps 50,000 in the long run is a drop in the bucket to an extent. And there may not be as much retention value for a film as there is for a TV series, which has far more bingeable units, lots more hours of engagement available, and helps keep you on the hook for longer. I think that this has been studied by a lot of outside factors, and in a conversation for Parrot Analytics' Global Demand Awards with Casey Bloys, it's been noted that pay-one movies, so theatrical films and their pay-one window on streamers, are huge, huge attractions for subscribers, and particularly keeping subscribers on the hook, and it's often a subscriber's first choice when they sign up for a platform. It's usually a pay-one movie. So I think that continues to kind of underscore how theatrical movies with these big marketing campaigns tend to perform better than streaming original movies. We've obviously seen many of these services pull back from streaming exclusive films. And even as Apple is switching strategies from theatrical to more streaming exclusive, they've even noted that they'll probably be at a slightly more lower mid-budget level. And I think as entertainment strategy guy, a great analyst, noted in one of his recent pieces, it's fair to ask, okay, if streaming exclusive films are coming in at lower budget levels than theatrical movies, that says something about the value they contribute in terms of subscriber acquisition and retention. And I tend to agree with him. And the data across the board shows that theatrical films tend to perform as good or better over kind of like the first month or longer of their time on streaming as streaming exclusive films. So, yeah.
No.
Continue.
The point about pay one TV. So, you know, just to clarify for folks, pay one TV is like this is the first stop a movie makes after theatrical. Like it's in theaters for, you know, 2 months. It's, you know, available to purchase on VOD or whatever, rent on VOD. And then it's on Netflix or Max or whatever. This is how I think of streamers. I think of them as essentially HBO replacements or FX replacements or whatever, right? And that makes sense to me. Like, yeah. People signed up for HBO not just for The Sopranos, but they signed up because every Saturday night at 8 p.m. there was a new blockbuster movie or new prestige movie that had been in theaters. It was cheaper than going to the theaters. You could wait till and watch it at home. And you lose that when you switch to originals. Again, I'm going to say this and it's going to sound condescending. I don't mean it to sound condescending, but it's when I think of streaming originals, I think of made for Lifetime movies. Right. I think of you, the consumer, in the consumer's mind, something that is not in theaters is inherently of a lower quality. And I really do think that that's an issue with the originals. I have a question, and I don't know if you can answer, maybe you can't answer this, maybe you don't know it off the top of your head. You said that the instigators got 50,000 new signups for Apple TV. Can I ask what Roadhouse did? Because I have another.
Yeah, I don't know that off the top of my head. I'm sure Parrot Analytics could probably run that calculation, but I don't know. What okay. I can say, though, just in general, and this is about kind of the whole topic here. Generally speaking, when we look at total platform audience demand, so that is accounting for original and licensed films and TV shows for the 8 premium SVOD services, TV in almost every single instances, I think except one, has more catalog demand from audiences than movies. So TV is driving more of that engagement and that attention and that buzz than movies across these major streamers. Mm-hmm. So I think that again speaks to like, what is the value proposition of TV versus film on streaming? And generally speaking, TV shows are probably doing more of the heavy lifting overall. Doesn't mean there's not a place for movies, doesn't mean there's not a place for streaming original movies, but I think it's always at the right budget level and the right expectations for ROI.
Yeah. All right, let's shift to your piece in The Observer, which I found fascinating because it clarified something in my head that I've been thinking about and trying to articulate for a bit. And it's this. One of the issues with a service like Apple that I hear about all the time from people. This is not my own perception. This is what I hear from other people all the time. Oh, that show's on Apple? I had no idea. I subscribe to Apple. What is this Slow Horses show? I hear this all the time about Slow Horses, in particular for some reason. Despite the fact that I frequently talk about Slow Horses. I say, it's great. People should go watch it. Everyone's like, wait, what is this Slow Horses show? So I am so fascinated by this because, like, again, I'm going to pick on Apple here, not because I'm, you know, I love Apple. It's one of my favorite streaming services. Oh, yeah. What I hear from folks all the time is, I had no idea that was on Apple. Why hasn't I subscribed to Apple? I still have an Apple subscription. I subscribed to watch Ted Lasso. I had no idea this was on there. And there is a audience information gap that I find both like fascinating and kind of troubling. But then there's this moment. There's a bit in your piece from The Observer. I just want to read it real quick because I think it's fascinating here. Retention driving content, in contrast, encourages subscribers to stay within a platform's ecosystem. According to Parrot Analytics, some of the top titles for retention in 2024 so far include Netflix, Captains of the World. 40% of audiences that watch this show watched another title available on Netflix US. Max, Property Brothers, Buying and Selling, 45.7%. Hulu, Dance Moms, 40.4%. Amazon, Dahad, 25.6%. Disney Plus's Marvel's The Defenders, 23.1%. Peacock, Winterhouse, 22.4%. Paramount Plus, FBI International, 22.2%. Now, I wanted to read all those because I think there's, at least in some circumstances here, you see a pattern, which is that a TV show that reflects the overall character of other things on the service is going to be more successful at keeping people on the site, right? So like Property Brothers makes sense as a show that drives more people to stay on Max, which is now half Discovery. People have to remember it's not just HBO, right? Or something like FBI International on Paramount Plus makes sense because Paramount Plus is also the CBS channel. It's like the CBS procedural channel. But if you watch that, you want to stick around. Marvel's The Defenders is the one that makes the most sense to me because if you're watching Marvel's The Defenders, you're watching all of the Marvel things. That is that's a niche Marvel program. It's not super well watched. It's not well loved or anything. But if you're watching that, you're probably watching all of the Marvel stuff. So that makes sense to me. Do these streaming companies have a brand problem in the sense that a lot of the times it's unclear exactly what Hulu. What is a Hulu show? I don't know what a Hulu show is. I don't know what an Apple show is. But I watch lots of things on those networks. Again, I'm weird. I'm unusual. But I can understand why I'll stop rambling here. I will get to the question. Do audiences understand what these streamers actually stand for? And does that matter?
I think it really, really helps to have a brand when it comes to originals. You know, what does this streaming service stand for? And before we started recording, we even noted that Netflix is one-stop shop, something for everyone. That's a brand within and of itself. I think the problem you run into is not every streaming service knows exactly what their brand of original is. And even if they do, they struggle to message that to consumers, which then, to your point, I think trickles down and perhaps impacts sampling. You know, like if I'm really, really sure that platform X represents genre or stylistically Y, then I'm definitely going to be like, you know, let me poke around. Let me just see their library, see if there's anything I want to give 10 minutes to see if I like it. When you're not sure as a consumer and you already have so much choice at the tip of your fingertips, just with one click away, it does help kind of nudge you to one direction or the other. If there's a little bit of a muddled kind of original brand coming from a streamer, you might be less likely because you have seven other major streaming services to choose from that you may feel you're more sure you can know what to expect from their library.
All right. The second question here then is how do the streaming companies overcome this? Because I watch Hulu. Right now I'm on Hulu. I'm watching Only Murders in the Building, right? Only Murders in the Building is on Hulu. We watch it, you know, I think we're maybe an episode behind right now, but we watch it on Fridays. That's when we catch up on the show. We watch it on Fridays. Here's a thing I realized the other day. There's a new season of What We Do in the Shadows coming. What We Do in the Shadows is a FX comedy. I have watched every episode of it on Hulu on FX or FX when it was just on TV. I have not gotten a single notification or heads up from Hulu or FX that there's another season of this coming. I just happened to see somebody tweet about it. You know, it's a thing that popped up into my feed. How can they not? I find it baffling that they are not personally like sending me advertisements on the home screen of Hulu. Like, hey, we got a new season of this coming. You should be aware of this and be ready for it. Why do these companies not know how to market their products? Brandon, why don't they know how to market their products?
It can be really frustrating. I have become the go-to directory for my family and my friends in that regard. They're like, hey, when is XYZ coming back? I'm like, I got you, man. Here you go. And it's tough because what you're talking about, too, in terms of advertising on the homepage, I think is vital because you can make a real strong case that the homepage of Netflix is the most valuable real estate in all of Hollywood right now. And one reason it is because Netflix, more so than every other platform, has invested in tech to ensure a user experience and user interface that is as effective as possible at surfacing something you like and then keeping you in the ecosystem once you're done. That includes advertising on the homepage right up top. Hey, we know that you watch this show, new season coming soon. That includes a video roll that happens every time you toggle over a different title so that you get a little kind of trailer in a sense of what the show's for. That results in how the default picture for every title will change depending on your viewing habits because Netflix's algorithm is trying to feed you something they think you'll like. It's not static. It actually changes. So my picture for Young Sheldon might actually be different than your picture for Young Sheldon. A lot of the other players either A, aren't doing that, or B, don't have the money to invest in it right now. And that may be a little bit more applicable to the legacy players that are trying to figure out a lot of different tough financial situations. So you're exactly right that title-specific marketing, reminders, and in-app discoverability and strategic algorithmic recommendations are all essential for reminding you of shows you like, nudging you towards new shows they think you'll like based on your watch history, and then strategically nudging you out of your comfort zone to sample something based on consumption affinity that will extract the full value of their library, even though it might not be like within the sci-fi genre that you watch 90% of the time. It is hard to do those things. Netflix's software is one reason why it is a market leader. Again, all these other players either have to redirect resources to it or find the money to do so, which is easier said than done.
Yeah. No, I'm sure I'm just saying things that everybody at these services are also saying, like, why can't we get people to watch our things? All right. So there was, let's see. Another thing you highlighted in your story was the shows that did not lead to people watching more things. And I just want to read off this list because, again, I find it pretty fascinating. Fool Me Once, Masters of the Air, Reacher, True Detective, Percy Jackson, Shogun, and Halo. Now, So Masters of the Air is Apple. Reacher is Prime, True Detective, Max, Percy Jackson, Disney Plus, Shogun, Hulu, and then Halo is Paramount Plus. And I can understand why those shows did not lead to more viewing necessarily, right? Either because something like True Detective does not really mesh with everything else that is on the Max / Discovery, the HBO / Discovery app that is Max, which is a total separate branding nightmare. Or something like Halo, right, which is on Paramount Plus, doesn't really mesh with the Sheridanverse. Masters of the Air, which is like, I think a lot of people just signed up for that because they're like, ooh, new Band of Brothers series. But it is fascinating because these are all very expensive shows. These are all very, very expensive shows. How many months do you have to stay signed up for a service to make the acquisition of that customer make sense financially?
So just to clarify too, the list of shows comes from Samba TV, which every 6 months releases a great data point on the shows by platform most likely to be the only shows watched by people who sign up just for one title and then don't watch anything else.
Yep.
And so that's where these shows came in from Samba TV. And it's super interesting because that speaks to shows that are good at acquiring new subscribers, but may not, but maybe in this instance, leaking viewership to other platforms afterwards. Now, according to a 2021 Deloitte research paper, streaming platforms need a subscriber to stay subscribed for up to 15 months, depending on what tier and what price they're paying, to start generating a return on investment for all the costs that they incur to acquire that subscriber. So if you're signing up, watching one big show and then canceling and churning out, well, that's a hamster wheel of a headache that the streaming executives are on at the moment.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about efforts to combat churn, because I do think there are a couple of strategies that seem to be working at least a little bit. One is bundling. How is bundling doing at slowing down people, you know, skipping from service to service?
Yeah, and this always just makes me snicker about the fickleness of audiences, understandably. We all got really upset with the pay TV bundle because it was bloated and we were paying a bunch of money for a bunch of channels we didn't want. And so that helped kind of push the technology and the industry towards streaming, where we have control of what we watch and how we watch. And that was great. We are in control of our own TV destinies. And then after a few years of that, we're like, you know what? Everything's too fragmented. I want everything in one place where, you know, I have to subscribe to too many things. And now with rebundling, we're kind of slowly moving back to certain pay TV model structures just grafted onto the internet. And so you see how that trend is a little cyclical and must be frustrating for the major entertainment providers. But bundling specifically is giving you a far more expansive content library for a more convenient price. Now we have bundles such as, you know, Verizon's Netflix and Max ad supported. We've got Comcast Stream Saver bundle, which is Netflix, Apple TV Plus, and Peacock. We've now got a Warner Brothers Disney bundle that has Disney Plus, Max, and Hulu. So we are having cross-company cooperation for these services to be offered together at a lower, more affordable price. And because subscribers are now getting a lot more bang for their buck in that regard, they're much less likely to cancel as opposed to if these services were just siloed individual on their own. Like we talked about up top, maybe I sign up for the new Star Wars and Marvel series for Disney Plus, and then I immediately churn out afterwards. But if I also have Hulu and Max, and I'm like, well, you know, after this Disney Plus show is over, HBO is debuting that new show I've been looking forward to, they're probably going to stay on board. I think the big kind of overarching long-term issue that no one's really talking about with all this bundling is that there's still no universal interface. As a consumer, as a subscriber, I still need to go into Disney Plus, log out, go into Hulu, log out, go into Max, log out. There's no single app experience. So it's far from seamless. It's far from convenient, at least compared to the pay TV bundle where everything was just in one system. So whoever is able to figure that out and get everyone to agree to a universal interface long-term is going to make a hell of a lot of money, Sonny.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's funny because Apple, my Apple TV Plus app kind of does that, at least in terms of keeping me up to date on what's happening on most of the other channels that I have something left to watch on. But it's not fully integrated. It doesn't work in super well, but it works. It points a way toward the future. What about sports? Sports feel like the last frontier here, really, of getting folks off of cable entirely and onto the streaming services. Have you seen any indication that sports are good at combating churn, or is it mostly acquisition?
Yeah, sports are obviously huge, huge, huge acquisition drivers. And within that, they're often loss leaders for those acquiring them. You know, NFL Sunday Ticket, according to public reports, you know, from Bloomberg and things like that, is, you know, usually not necessarily generating an ROI, but it's getting more people into the YouTube ecosystem. And that's a huge, huge, huge benefit for a lot of reasons. They can help reduce churn, but you're often seeing off-season churn if there's not a kind of strong foundation, back end of the funnel to rely on. I think Netflix's approach has actually been really smart because they spent 10 plus years building up a library of really splashy originals and a lot of retention driving licensed programming, and are now starting to go to the top of the funnel by adding sports in a really selective, careful manner. So I think they've actually done it really well. I think Amazon, you know, with a huge, huge, huge library of content and continually adding more sports, including NBA after this upcoming season, to go along with Thursday Night Football, that's going to be a really, really solid value proposition for consumers. I think when in the next media deals for some of these programs, some of these sports leagues, you might not see as high of prices for the media rights deals. And that's when we might see that kind of final transition to streaming, and where streaming might get a little bit more ROI from these sports leagues. But yeah, for now, clearly the migration is happening, it's ongoing, and that is bad news for linear TV because sports are pretty much the last vestige of hope.
Yeah, yeah. That was pretty much everything I wanted to ask. What else should folks know about audience acquisition and audience retention? What should the people out there keep in mind when they're churning from one service to another? Don't they ever think about the damage they're doing to these executives and these companies? Can't they be a little more thoughtful?
Oh no, who will support the multi-million and billion-dollar companies out there? My God, someone think of them. I would say that I don't blame them often, because I think one thing I note in the Observer article is that green light, renewal, and cancellation decisions are often made with the acquisition side of things in mind, and re-engaging high-risk subscribers who are at risk of churning out because they are infrequent viewers on your service. And so we've got this imbalance where so many resources are directed to kind of broad appeal acquisition drivers and shows that may hit on those high-risk subscribers. And we're not getting as many shows created that are like, you know what, this could really keep our existing base engaged longer term. And I think that creates a dangerous imbalance, because it works for platforms that still need to add market share. And right now, pretty much everyone except Netflix needs to add market share. But once you hit a ceiling, once a market becomes saturated, like the U.S. is, and like Netflix has kind of more or less hit a viewer, a subscriber ceiling in the U.S. and UK market, that then begins to not be a sustainable business model. The economics start to kind of fall apart because you're spending huge resources on blockbuster home run swings, and you're just engaging the same core group. You're not adding really a ton of new subscribers. So longer term, I think that's something all services need to think about and maybe have a bit more of a 50-50 balance in terms of what they're greenlighting, what they're renewing, and what they're canceling in terms of the value it derives. Are we engaging and retaining, or are we acquiring new subscribers? It's a Jenga tower for sure, but the most successful services will figure out a good balance of both.
Yeah. Brandon, thank you for being on. Really, always a pleasure to get you on to discuss the strategies involved in making what we watch.
Thank you for having me on, Sonny. I really appreciate it. Always like just ranting uncontrollably about this crazy industry.
I'm pro rants. We need more rants. All right. Once again, I am Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.